Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I can't be here live today, so I decided we'd do a little journal club experience about an amazing researcher who is reversing dementia. Reversing dementia not someday in the future with experimental molecules that can be patented and sold at high prices, but right now with materials and methods that you and your loved ones can put into action. His game-changing paper, Reversal of Cognitive Decline, was published in 2014 in the journal Aging, and we'll be doing a deep dive today into this research and how you can put the information in action in your life. But first, a little information about Dr. Dale Bredesen. Dr. Bredesen is a well-respected research scientist with over 30 years of work and hundreds of published articles in peer-reviewed journals. His early work was in programmed cell death of nerve tissue, a process referred to as neuron apoptosis. Later, he focused on Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease and the mechanisms by which the cell's mitochondria signal another organelle in the cell to initiate a self-destruct sequence. Later, he began researching ways to inhibit cell death. He and others discovered that one major trigger for the self-destruct switch was oxygen. This sounds a little odd at first to the layperson. Don't our brain cells need oxygen? Well, yes, of course, but oxygen also has a dark side. It reacts with things and changes them chemically. Think about rust. Think about fire. These two examples that we're all familiar with cannot happen if there is no oxygen present. Oxygen is friendly. When atmospheric oxygen, two molecules, break apart, the single molecules are lonely and immediately look for something to react with. In reacting, they often change the structural properties of the compounds they react with. One prime example is DNA. We've known that oxygen interacts with DNA and damages it for many, many years. In fact, much of the work on cancer prevention has focused on reducing oxidative stress. And that's where Dr. Bredesen's work comes in. The same mechanism by which oxygen interferes with DNA and leads to mutations is also at work in our brains constantly. Many things create extra oxygen. They're called oxygen-free radicals, and medically, we often refer to this as oxidative stress. But oxidative stress is also one of the major mechanisms by which our bodies keep us safe. Our white blood cells use it to kill bacteria. Thus, there's a delicate balance that needs to be understood. And that's where Dr. Bredesen's many years of research come in. Dr. Bredesen suggests that we need to take a network-based approach rather than a target-based approach. The key concept in this groundbreaking paper is the idea of a comprehensive combination therapy. So, for a way to understand Dr. Bredesen's explanation of all the research findings, I'm going to give you a visual image rather than drowning you in terminology. In Alzheimer's disease, we see an accumulation of amyloid beta, which is a protein that is toxic and triggers nerve cell death. Think B is for bad. That's easy to remember. Now imagine a string of beads. That's how we'll visualize the amyloid precursor protein. This string has three yellow beads, then three red beads, then six green beads. Now there are two pairs of robot scissors in the cell. The alpha scissors cut right after the last red bead and make amyloid alpha. The beta scissors cut right after the first green bead and make amyloid beta. The three yellow, three red fragment left over from the alpha scissors is another set of alpha scissors and makes more alpha amyloid, which is harmless. The 3 yellow, 3 red, 1 green fragment left over after the beta scissors cut the breaks. The 3 yellow, 3 red, 1 green fragment left over after the beta scissors cut breaks into another set of beta scissors and a second compound that actually impairs the breakdown of beta amyloid, so it accumulates more rapidly. It's kind of like the Sorcerer's Apprentice segment in Fantasia. The beta fragments of amyloid precursor protein make more beta fragments and amplify the problem. Brains drowned in beta amyloid that is built up too quickly to be broken down. And when the mess accumulates past a certain threshold, well, the mitochondria step in and trigger cell death, and memory and skills evaporate. So the basic tenets of Dr. Bredesen's work are that we need to identify the factors that create more beta scissors and eliminate those, and identify the markers that create more alpha scissors and magnify those. So the first step in that is optimizing the measurable nutritional markers that lead to that goal, creating more alpha scissors and fewer beta scissors. The second basic tenet of this paper is to address each and every feasible factor that can be reached. The third premise is that if you can achieve a threshold of alpha over beta, you break the cycle of nerve degeneration. And that's what makes this paper so exciting, is that there are some demonstrable case studies in which this appears to have been achieved. I'll be telling about those in a few minutes. The fourth tenet is the importance of personalizing the approach, measuring the individual lab values, and identifying what needs to be shifted in a given individual based on their genetics and the markers that can be measured. When I come back in July, I'll have more information about this, as I plan to attend a conference that is dedicated to the preservation of the brain in early June of this year. In fact, I'm at that conference right now while you're listening to this program. We're going to jump into a few case studies now because they're very impressive. And before we go any further, I want to just say that none of the people in these case studies was able to perfectly achieve the program that we're going to lay out for them. You have to do the best you can. But the point is that it is humanly possible to achieve reversal of fairly significant disability using this program. So let's start with our first case. A 67-year-old woman presented with 2 years of progressive memory loss. She held a demanding job that involved preparing analytical reports and traveling widely, but found herself no longer able to analyze data or prepare the reports, and was therefore forced to consider quitting her job. She noted that when she would read, by the time she reached the bottom of a page, she would have to start at the top once again, since she was unable to remember the material she'd just read. She was no longer able to remember numbers and had to write down even a 4-digit number to remember them. She also began to have trouble navigating on the road, even on familiar roads. She would become lost trying to figure out where to enter or exit the road, and she also noticed that she would mix up the names of her pets and forget where the light switches were in her home, where she'd lived for years. Spooky, huh? Her mother had developed similar progressive cognitive decline beginning in her early 60s and had become severely demented, entering a nursing home, and died at approximately 80 years of age. When the patient consulted her physicians about her problems, she was told that she had the same problem her mother had had and that there was nothing that he could do about it. He wrote memory problems in her chart, and therefore the patient was turned down in her application for long-term care insurance. After she was informed that she had the same problem as her mother had had, she recalled the many years of her mother's decline in a nursing home. knowing that there was still no effective treatment and subsequently losing the ability to purchase long-term care, she decided to commit suicide. She called a friend to commiserate, who suggested that she get on a plane and visit, and then referred her for evaluation. She began System 1.0 and was able to adhere to some but not all of the protocol components. Nevertheless, after 3 months, she noted that all of her symptoms had abated. She was able to navigate without problems, remember telephone numbers without difficulty, prepare reports, and do all of her work without difficulty, read, retain information, and overall, she became asymptomatic. She noted that her memory was now better than it had been in many years. On one occasion, she developed an acute viral illness and discontinued the program and noticed a decline, which reversed when she reinstated the program. 2.5 years later, now age 70, she remains asymptomatic and continues to work full-time. So what was this miraculous therapeutic program? Following an extended discussion of the components of the therapeutic program, the patient began on some, but not all, of the system. Number one, she eliminated all simple carbohydrates, that's sugar and white flour and starch, and increased vegetables, fruits, and non-farmed fish. This led to a weight loss of 20 pounds. She also eliminated gluten and processed food from her diet. 3, in order to reduce stress, she began yoga and ultimately became a yoga instructor. 4, as a second measure to reduce the stress of her job, she began to meditate 20 minutes twice per day. 5, she took a 0.5 milligram of melatonin every night at bedtime. 6, she increased her sleep from the 4 to 5 hours at night of her baseline to 7 to 8 hours per night. 7, she took methyl B12 1 milligram each day. 8, she took vitamin D3 2,000 units each day. 9, she took fish oil 2,000 milligrams each day. 10, she took CoQ10 200 milligrams each day. 11, she optimized her oral hygiene using an electric flosser and electric toothbrush. And I'm going to stop there and parenthetically tell you that inflammation from gum disease is a strong risk factor for dementia. And if you aren't taking good care of your teeth, you need to start pronto, because this is a big one, folks. 12, following a discussion with her primary care provider, she reinstated hormone replacement therapy that had been discontinued following the Women's Health Initiative report in 2002. And regular listeners will know what I think of that study. 13, she fasted for a minimum of 12 hours between dinner and breakfast, and for a minimum of 3 hours between dinner and bedtime. The reason for this is that when you fast, your cellular disposal trucks are available to get rid of cellular trash, and that's when the beta amyloid gets eliminated. And 14, she exercised for a minimum of 30 minutes, 4 to 6 days per week. We know that exercise increases something called nerve growth factor in the brain and leads to the formation and replacement of synapses and dying neurons. Here's case study number 2. A 69-year-old entrepreneur and professional man presented with 11 years of slowly progressive memory loss, which had accelerated over the past 1 or 2 years. In 2002, at the age of 58, he had been unable to recall the combination of the lock on his locker, and he felt that this was out of the ordinary for him. In 2003, he had a fluorodeoxyglucose positron emission tomography test, which was read as showing a pattern typical for early Alzheimer's disease. This test, which uses radioactive glucose to measure brain activity, showed reduced glucose utilization in the parietal temporal cortices bilaterally, with the left deficit greater than the right in the temporal lobes, and preserved utilization in the frontal lobe, occipital cortex, and basal ganglia. In 2003, 2007, and 2013, he had quantitative neuropsychological testing, which showed a reduction in the California Verbal Learning Test from the 84th percentile to the first percentile, a Stroop color test at 16th percentile, and a delayed auditory memory at 13%. In 2013, he had genetic testing and was found to be heterozygous for APOE4. He noted that he had progressive difficulty recognizing faces at work. This is called prosopagnosia, and had to have his assistants prompt him with the daily schedule. He also recalled an event during which he was several chapters into a book before he realized that it was a book he had read previously. In addition, he lost an ability he had had for most of his life, the ability to add columns of numbers rapidly in his head. I'm going to skip the next paragraph where Dr. Bredesen talks about the biomarkers in this patient and what they showed. But just in the highlights, he had normal testosterone, normal cholesterol, low inflammatory markers, and a good hemoglobin A1C. But what he did have that was abnormal was a high homocysteine and a very, very high level of copper relative to zinc. His thyroid was functioning okay, and his weight was in normal limits. He began on the therapeutic program, and after 6 months, his wife, co-workers, and he all noted improvement. He had lost 10 pounds. He was able to recognize faces at work, unlike before, was able to remember his daily schedule, and was able to function at work without difficulty. He was also noted to be quicker with his responses. His lifelong ability to add columns of numbers rapidly in his head, which he had lost, returned. His wife pointed out, although he had clearly shown improvement, the most striking effect was that he had been accelerating in his decline over the prior year or two, and this had completely halted. So what was this patient's therapeutic program? Well, he fasted a minimum of 3 hours between dinner and bedtime, and for a minimum of 12 hours between dinner and breakfast. He eliminated simple carbohydrates and processed food from his diet. He increased consumption of vegetables and fruits, and limited consumption of fish to non-farmed and meat to occasional grass-fed beef or organic chicken. He took probiotics. He took coconut oil, 1 teaspoon twice a day. He exercised strenuously, swimming 3 to 4 times a week, cycling twice per week, and running once per week. He took a 0.5 milligram of melatonin at bedtime and tried to sleep as close to 8 hours per night as his schedule would allow. He took herbs, bacoba, monaria, ashwagandha, turmeric. He took methylcobalamin, that's methyl B12, and methyl folate, and pyridoxine 5-phosphate. And he took citricholine, a precursor for the cell wall of neurons. He took 1 gram of vitamin C a day, 5,000 international units of vitamin D, 400 units of vitamin E, 200 milligrams of CoQ10, 50 milligrams of zinc picolinate, remember that low zinc level, and 100 milligrams of alpha lipoic acid a day. He also took a low dose of DHA and EPA, which are components of fish oil. The wonderful thing about this paper is that these doses have been empirically arrived at through scientific studies, and they're actually very low compared to the doses that you'll find in some supplements. So it seems very reasonable that there's a synergy or a multiplicative effect when you add all of these components into an individual, which has long been my idea. Case history number 3. A 55-year-old attorney suffered progressively severe memory loss for 4 years. She accidentally left the stove on when she left her home on multiple occasions and then returned, horrified to see that she left it on once again. She would forget meetings and agree to multiple meetings at the same time. Because of an inability to remember anything after a delay, she would record conversations, and she carried an iPad on which she took copious notes, but then she forgot the password to her iPad. She'd been trying to learn Spanish as a part of her job, but was unable to remember virtually anything new. She was unable to perform her job, and she sat her children down to explain to them that they could no longer take advantage of her poor memory, that instead they must understand that her memory loss was a serious problem. Her children noted that she frequently became lost in mid-sentence, that she was slow with responses, and that she frequently asked if they had followed up on something she thought she'd asked them to do, when in fact she had never asked them to do the tasks to which she referred. Her homocysteine was 9.8. Her inflammatory markers were low. Her hemoglobin A1C was also low. And her hormone levels were actually pretty decent, with a low insulin and decent thyroid functioning. All of the things that a conventional doctor could possibly think of to check on a dementia workup. After 5 months on her therapeutic program, she noted she no longer needed her iPad for notes and no longer needed to record conversations. She was able to work once again, was able to learn Spanish, and began to learn a new legal specialty. Her children noted she no longer became lost in mid-sentence, no longer thought she had asked them to do something she had not asked, and answered their questions with normal rapidity and memory. This is going to sound familiar now. She began on the following therapeutic program. She fasted for a minimum of 3 hours between dinner and bedtime, and for a minimum of 12 hours between dinner and breakfast. She eliminated simple carbohydrates and processed food from her diet. She increased her consumption of fruits and vegetables, limited consumption of fish to non-farmed, and did not eat meat. She exercised 4 to 5 times per week. She took melatonin, 0.5 milligram at bedtime, and tried to sleep as close to 8 hours per night as her schedule would allow. She tried to reduce stress in her life with meditation and relaxation. She took some methyl B12 and some pyridoxine 5-phosphate. She took citricholine, that precursor for the cell wall. She took vitamin D3 and CoQ10, DHA and EPA, which are omega-3 fatty acids, about 1,200 milligrams of these twice daily. She also started on bioidentical estradiol and progesterone, and she worked with her primary care doctor to reduce the amount of antidepressants that she was taking. There are another 7 cases in this paper that are not described as fully. Of the 10 cases studied, 9 improved. Those who had left work or were contemplating leaving work were able to resume working at a normal functional level. Those who had quit working and were retired did not return to work, but did not suffer further decline. One patient, aged 60, who had a positive amyloid PET scan for Alzheimer's and was in late Alzheimer's disease at the time of entry into the study, did not improve. So this clearly indicates that there is a critical period where you can break the cycle, change the thresholds, and rebuild your brain. But if things get rolling and have too much momentum, well, it's rather like an avalanche at that point, and there's no stopping it. We must identify the factors in a given individual that are most critical. And there are a number of markers in the bloodstream that we can use to do that, that were used in this study. So what are some of the important biological markers? What are some of the things that you can ask your doctor to test? Well, number one is the zinc to copper ratio. And this can be a serum test, easy to get from routine lab testing. If there's a high copper and a low zinc, you're in trouble for your brain, and there's also an increased cancer risk. You'll want to filter your water if you have copper pipes, and definitely increase your zinc with supplementation. Up to 50 milligrams of zinc is considered safe when there's a high copper level. Another factor that some people have is absence of a protein called ceruloplasmin, which binds copper, and that too is a routine lab test that can be checked. You'll want to look at your hemoglobin A1C. That's, well, basically an indicator of how high your blood sugar has been. And if it's elevated, that indicates high insulin levels in anyone but a type 1 diabetic. insulin competes with amyloid beta for breakdown by the enzymes that process it. So you certainly don't want to slow down your amyloid beta breakdown by having high blood sugar and therefore high insulin. A third one is high sensitivity C-reactive protein. This is often called cardio-CRP because conventional medicine recognizes it as a risk factor for heart disease, but it's also a risk factor for dementia. Inflammation biases the system towards increased amounts of amyloid beta and interferes with the breakdown of amyloid beta. As I mentioned, that's a race. Break it down before it builds up so that the mitochondria don't trigger cell death. Homocysteine is a blood acid that goes up when there are low levels of B12 or problems processing folic acid. Independent studies doing just B12 and folic acid supplementation in people with early dementia have shown fairly significant improvement, but taken in concert with all of these other measures, it's extremely powerful. Your homocysteine level should be below 8, although if you look at lab tests, the reference range considers 12 normal. Well, it may be normal, and it may be typical, and it may be average in people with no apparent current disease, but it's not optimal. And that's what we're going after here. We're going after optimizing these markers so that we can reduce the global risk of dementia. You also want to get a sleep study and rule out sleep apnea. If you have any of the red flag symptoms for this, and that includes snoring and daytime drowsiness, particularly in the afternoon. You need 8 hours of good quality sleep, and you don't want to deprive your brain of oxygen episodically throughout the night, because that generates, ironically enough, inflammation and reactive oxygen species. If you're female, you definitely want to get hormone testing and consider hormone supplementation, because the data is very clear that this is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease in susceptible individuals. And finally, physical activity is key. Now, obviously, you'll lie to your doctor about your physical activity, but don't lie to yourself. You need 20 minutes a day of moderate physical activity. Get a calculator. Take 220 and subtract your age. Now calculate 80% of that number. That's your target heart rate for that 20 minutes. Weightlifting is also very good, maybe even better, but be prudent to avoid injury, since if you go too gung-ho and injure yourself, the subsequent inactivity during your period of recovery is much, much worse than the biggest toxin dose that we can imagine. Other things to think about are heavy metal toxicity, and in people who have a history of exposure to metals like cadmium or lead, people who solder, people who do ceramics with lead glazes, people who've traveled or spent a couple of years in China on business, these would all be individuals where I would go looking for heavy metals and work to get those out of the body if I found them. So what am I saying? Ultimately, I'm saying that Dr. Bredesen's work gives me a sense of hope that this is not genetics is destiny, that this is not an, oh, too bad, so sad, you're going to be in a nursing home. This is something that you can take action on and turn around. It takes dedication and perseverance, but these case studies give me a real sense of optimism that it is possible and achievable, and I wanted to share that good news with you today. I'm always talking about the microbiome. In fact, between that and epigenetics, I probably don't seem to talk about anything else, but these are two of the greatest game changers, the greatest paradigm shifts in the entire 30 years that I've been a doctor. And so it's important to get the word out and to understand and observe the scientific process as we discover more and we learn how to use these new tools which have been presented to us through discovery and research and new technologies which allowed those very discoveries. It's really analogous to the situation when the microscope was invented and suddenly those evil humors turned out to be little tiny animals in the water causing cholera. Epigenetics, the genome, and the CRISPR-Cas9 discovery, that's on the order of the microscope or the telescope. The human genome, amazing, but only the very beginning. As we're now learning, there are all kinds of adjectives and adverbs and other modifiers that make the genetic code into the complex and amazing thing that it is. And speaking of complex and amazing, OMG, the microbiome, and the fact that there are at least 10 and probably more like 100 times more DNA messages in our gut than in our entire human genome. How does that work? And what kind of crosstalk and communication is taking place? We're barely scratching the surface there. But I'm going to bring it down to, well, let's just say the ground floor. And let's talk about antibiotics. And what do you do when you've had to take antibiotics? How do you rebuild your microbiome? What do we know about dosing and frequency and which antibiotics do the most damage? Now, recent research using something called quantitative PCR, looking at bacterial DNA, has shown that when you take a course of antibiotics, you get about a 90% die-off of volume of bacteria in your intestines. Now, hopefully, you get 90% of the thing you're trying to kill, but that might be in your throat or in your skin. But the good guys in your intestine also take, what we would call in political speak, collateral damage, but it's big collateral damage. One little-known fact is that intravenous antibiotics are just as bad and in some cases even worse than oral antibiotics. That blood goes round and round and it gets into the intestines. And as anyone who has ever smelled penicillin on their urine knows, it gets into the urine. Timing is also critical. Use of antibiotics early in life has a worse effect than antibiotics later in adulthood. And when I say worse effects, I'm not talking about just the microbiome. There are actually measurable effects on neurocognitive scores in children who had lots of antibiotics in infancy. This was published in a peer review journal in 2017, written by Slykerman, S-L-Y-K-E-R-M-A-N, and you can look it up in Acta Pediatrica, volume 106. There's also an association with asthma later in life. This was published in 2014 in the British Medical Journal. Antibiotics have also been associated with obesity and weight gain in children as well as adults. That was published in Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Disease, volume 19, number 4, in 2013. But how does this work? Well, one of the things that can happen with antibiotics is that they cause the release of toxic lipopolysaccharides. These are large molecules from the cell wall of the bacteria. That's one of the targets of many antibiotics, including all of the psyllin drugs. Damage the cell wall and the guts leak out. Well, the damaged fragments of cell wall can leak across the gut wall and inflame the immune system. You can measure an increase in inflammatory cytokines in people after antibiotic treatment. At the moment, therapy is largely empirical. In other words, we make it up as we go along, and then we check to see if we got the results we were after. One good rule of thumb is 1 month of active probiotic treatment for every week that a person was on antibiotics. Those who've been on prolonged continuous antibiotics, say you had a blood infection and had to use antibiotics for a month, you're probably going to need a year of probiotic therapy to get anywhere back to a healthy microbiome. You're also going to need to give probiotics, which are the bacteria, and prebiotics, which are the bacteria chow. More about that in a couple of minutes. The inside of the intestine is covered with a kind of a sugar crust called the glycocalyx. This is like a layer of protection that helps the gut not leak these lipopolysaccharides. And it protects the microvilli, which are your absorptive surfaces, letting the good stuff in and keeping some, if not all, of the bad stuff out. Long-term or multiple courses of antibiotics show on biopsy a decline in the thickness of the glycocalyx and also in the height of the microvilli. And it's long been known that long-term use of antibiotics causes nutritional deficiencies of multiple key vitamins, but especially vitamin B12 and vitamin K. The intestinal wall produces an antibody called IgA, which is a major protection against yeast overgrowth. Your good bacteria, Lactobacillus and Bifidobacterium, really need a nice thick loamy soil, a nice thick glycocalyx to put their roots down. Now that's a metaphor, but the thinner the glycocalyx, the more like a rock garden rather than an English cottage garden you're going to have growing in your gut. And you want those cottage garden flowers so that you can get the butterflies and the rest of a complex ecosystem, which is what makes the microbiome so beautiful. So a good gut gardener, after a course of antibiotics, is going to leverage a beneficial microorganism called Saccharomyces boulardii. This is an antibiotic, probiotic yeast, and Saccharomyces boulardii stimulates the production of glycocalyx and of IgA secretion. It does other things as well. It stimulates the enzymes on the brush border, which is the surface of the small intestine. It promotes the production of compounds that actually feed the intestinal microvilli cells, and it's helpful for healing things like ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, and irritable bowel syndrome. It's also able to work against the terrible antibiotic infection that's so difficult to treat and cure, Clostridium difficile. It has been used successfully as a preventative therapy against C. difficile-associated diarrhea. This was published in the Clinical Infectious Disease Journal in 2015, volume 60. It also inhibits certain bacterial toxins and prevents the formation of others. But Saccharomyces actually colonizes damaged endothelium and gets rid of pathogenic, that is to say, infectious yeast that can do damage, while simultaneously rehabilitating the protection. S. boulardii effectively eats candida for breakfast. According to unpublished studies by a woman named Dr. Skelton, who is a Australian doctor who works with a company called Bioceuticals, so let's be clear, this is a commercial statement on her part, but she has unpublished data that she presented at a conference showing that it takes about 4 weeks of therapy with standard Saccharomyces boulardii strains at 500 milligrams a capsule to achieve reconstitution of the glycocalyx and restoration of normal levels of IgA. That's not bad. But that company, Bioceuticals, has what they claim is a much more powerful version of Saccharomyces, which contains 12 different subspecies plus 14 strains of other bacteria that they say can get the job done in a week. Again, no peer-reviewed studies to back that up, but it's an interesting thing to look at, and if you were looking at products, you might want to look at theirs. I typically use products by a company called Claire, K-L-A-I-R-E, and part of my allegiance to them is related to the fact that they produce a really excellent children's probiotic and have some published data to back up the formula. Now, some people can't tolerate probiotics, and there's two reasons for that. In the short term, particularly with Saccharomyces boulardii, when you start taking that particular beneficial yeast, if you have a lot of bad yeast in your system, you're going to kill it. And you're going to have fragments of dead yeast leaking across that damaged bowel wall. And it's going to generate activity in your immune system. Your immune system is going to read those signals as a red alert and put out cytokines. And you're going to feel flu-y, like you're coming down with something, maybe achy as well. Possibly some stomach cramps or diarrhea, but it passes very quickly, a day at the most. And it's usually delayed by about 3 days. So 3 days in, you get sick, persevere. Take the stuff for another couple of days before you give up on it. If the symptoms fade, keep taking it. You've just had a die-off reaction, or what's sometimes called in natural medicine circles, a Herxheimer reaction. But there's another group of people, and these are people who generally are chronically ill. They may have been in septic shock and received high-dose antibiotics, or had a hemorrhage requiring a transfusion, and they have a severely damaged intestinal wall and a severely dysregulated nervous system. And in that situation, you really have to start at the bowel wall barrier functioning and give a host of things that in functional medicine we call the 5R protocol. These involve things like zinc and L-glutamine, omega-3 fatty acids, vitamin A, and in people who, if they do get their fecal IgA tested, and there is a Quest test for that, so it's commercially available, if that's low, then using bovine colostrum, which is the milk, the pre-milk that happens when a cow first starts to lactate, and just like humans, we produce this yellowish fluid that is chock full of antibodies for the first day or so before the milk comes in. Well, you can harvest that stuff, and it is chock full of bovine IgA, which will work just fine to pinch hit for your own IgA. And so that can be one of the most important therapies for people with really severely damaged guts, or people who are trying to recover from a seemingly endless bout of stomach upset after a long course of antibiotics. A lot of people with yeast overgrowth will take things like oregano oil or powdarco. And while these are good at killing candida, they are also good at killing S. boulardii. So if you're trying to use beneficial yeast therapy, you don't want to be taking any of the plant microbials. And a lot of times I'll see those mixed in when a person comes in with their supplements. And I basically have to tell them, you're spinning your wheels here. You have to choose what tactic you're going to take in this particular war. And as I said, I'm a gut gardener, so rather than a flamethrower, I'd rather use a ground cover. Now, there's a couple of other things that you can do when you're trying to recover from a course of antibiotics. And one of them is, if it's been a long course, you probably want to avoid gluten, at least for a while. Say, while you're trying to do your rehab, maybe a month. Keep the doses down. You don't have to avoid it like the plague, the way someone with celiac disease does. But you can think of gluten as a little bit like sandpaper. You're trying to get a nice finish on the intestine. You don't want to use rough sandpaper and break up the layers that you're putting down. Some of the best foods to eat are stewed apples and root vegetables. When you cook apples, you release more pectin, and that's one of the best prebiotics out there. Inulin, which can be found in jicama, which is widely available in California anyway, is another good source of prebiotics to help those bacteria that you want get established. What are the bad bacteria like? Sugar and cream. So reducing those is also a good idea while you're trying to nurture that healthy ground cover. One of the foods that's currently just got legendary status in my community is bone broth. And indeed, bone broth, because of the way it's made, has higher levels of collagen. Remember when you used to open up a can of ham? I don't know if anybody opens up canned ham. Certainly not in this part of California. But that clear, pinkish jello-y stuff, that was pure collagen. And that's what you want. You can also just take Knox gelatin, but I don't like where that comes from. In any event, bone broth or other sources of collagen act like, well, almost spackle to help replace that glycocalyx, and that too is a prebiotic. It can be digested by the healthy bacteria in the gut. Butyrate, which is in butter, and there, if you're going to be eating foods to help restore the gut, use clarified butter or ghee, which I just saw on the shelf at Trader Joe's in a jar, so no work involved, although there's some lovely YouTube videos about how to make clarified butter if you want to do it that way. That's certainly cheaper. Butyrate helps speed up healing of the actual intestinal wall. If you don't want to buy expensive probiotics, then forms of yogurt, sauerkraut, and kimchi contain beneficial bacteria and are excellent. Doesn't take that much. If you've got the prebiotics on hand, the dose of sauerkraut is about 2 forkfuls, so call it 1/8 of a cup. And even sauerkraut haters can find a way to disguise that in a salad without too much effort. The sauerkraut can't be heated. If you're going to use these vegetables, you can't get them above 80 degrees before you put them in your mouth. So no sauerkraut casserole is going to provide you with the bacteria, although it still contains a lot of healthy prebiotics. And if you like that, it's good for you. So in summary, if you've had antibiotics at all, you want to consider fixing your microflora. I typically have people use Bifidobacterium and Lactobacillus, at least 2 different strains of each, and a dose of around 50, that's 50 billion organisms for a couple of weeks. I like the idea that you're going to take the probiotics for at least a month after you finish the antibiotics. And I want to emphasize the safety of these agents. These are not showing up, despite the fact that they are now in wide use. We're not seeing people with sepsis from probiotics. We're not seeing people get diarrhea from probiotics. In fact, I actually use very high doses to turn off diarrhea when the standard over-the-counter medications aren't working. 300 billion organisms, that's about 12 capsules of the ones that I use, which are 25 billion each. You give someone 300 billion every time they have a loose stool, and it works just as well as Imodium does. Not quite sure what the mechanism is, but I'm also not worried about hurting anybody by giving them back the bacteria that should be there in the first place. I still encounter doctors who will say to me with a reasonable amount of skepticism, leaky gut, that's not really an established thing, is it? In a very challenging way. And, well, they're right to ask for data. And so I'm going to share with you some very interesting data, not all that new, published in 2014, showing actual real-time photos of leaky gut and proving that when a person who has a food allergy eats a food they're allergic to, they actually have changes in the physical structure of their bowel, which can be observed with this 1,000 times magnification. The technology is called confocal laser endomicroscopy. And these devices can be placed on a standard endoscope and used to take very high resolution images. In a study published in Gastroenterology 2014, volume 147, number 5, Fisher and Ravens and a group of other researchers at multiple centers looked at 36 patients with irritable bowel syndrome and suspected food intolerance. These individuals were actually exposed during their endomicroscopy, and in 22 out of 36, real-time changes were seen within 5 minutes. They included endothelial leaks and visible gaps and widening of the intervillous spaces, which are the main barrier that keeps large allergic fragments from getting across the bowel wall and into that forest of lymph nodes that exist just under the endothelium. They also had a smaller group of patients with Barrett's esophagus, a precancerous condition of the esophagus who did not have food allergies, who did not show these changes when exposed to allergens. Standard endoscopy would not show these changes. Among patients who were positive on this test, their symptom scores for IBS improved by more than 50% following 4 weeks on diets that excluded the foods to which they had tested sensitive. Now, the sensitivity and specificity and practicality of using endomicroscopy for diagnostic purposes, well, it's clearly not going to be a good test, as there are hundreds of potential food antigens. But it does show proof of concept for the idea that the intestinal wall can change very rapidly and become leaky when exposed to certain compounds. And that proof of concept is valuable when you're trying to convince a skeptical audience of doctors. It sounds like a subject change, but I want to pull in Alzheimer's disease here for a moment. Researchers all over the world are starting to reframe Alzheimer's as an inflammatory disease, mediated at least partially by diet. In fact, some people call it type 3 diabetes because Alzheimer's disease is so much more common in diabetics who are, by definition, inflamed. There's a lot of interesting detail here, but let's pull it back to the microbiome. There is data in human subjects that connects the dots. The leaky gut and the microbiome go hand in hand with diet. Here's how it works. When you eat a diet high in saturated fat, sugar, and low in fiber, you cause alterations in your microbiome. And one of those changes is that the bacteria that you've got in there make more endotoxin. The endotoxin damages this fragile barrier functioning, making for a leaky gut, and the endotoxin leaks through across the leaky gut and is able to cross into the brain, where it interferes with the blood-brain barrier, making that leaky as well. Researchers have identified adverse changes in hippocampal function. Hippocampus is where you do your memory, and so when your hippocampus isn't functioning, you start looking like an Alzheimer's patient. So the researchers conclude from their study that Western diet consumption increases production of endotoxins by commensal bacteria, which may promote neuroinflammation and cognitive dysfunction. So what happens if you eat that diet and you're constantly producing endotoxin and you're constantly irritating your immune system? Well, eventually you get systemic inflammation because those lymph nodes in the intestine produce inflammatory cytokines, the same kind of chemical signals that are released when you have the flu. And this causes upregulation everywhere. So if you have a little bit of arthritis, that might flare. If you have a little bit of sinus congestion, that might flare. And of course, if you have a little bit of brain dysfunction, the inflammation in your brain might impair your functioning on standardized testing, which is exactly what happened in this study by Noble that was published in Frontiers of Behavioral Neuroscience in 2017. There's a study by Dalutatsai in CNS Neurological Disorders and Drug Targets, 2015, that showed that at least in some people, grain-based proteins can trigger immune-mediated gut dysbiosis, affect the gut-brain axis, dysregulate the metabolism, increase measurably in the bloodstream pro-inflammatory cytokines, and have effects on cognitive testing. So what can I offer you in the way of practical recommendations here? Well, limit saturated fat and carbohydrates, processed foods, and sugars. Eat a diet rich in lean proteins. Eat lots of fiber-rich fruits and vegetables. Whole grain foods such as flax seeds, also even the less glycemic grains such as quinoa, are perfectly acceptable because they do not have this property of kicking up the endotoxemia. Foods rich in omega-3 fatty acids reduce inflammation in the gut and are thus protective. So along with flax seeds, we have walnuts, avocados, salmon, and other fatty fish. Probiotics themselves are anti-inflammatory. So if you're going to indulge, it might be the time to take an extra probiotic capsule and maybe some vitamin C with your Whopper. And finally, a very bit of practical advice. Don't eat on the run. Chew your food. Pay attention to what you're eating. And don't allow yourself to be distracted, because your digestion is very influenced by the thoughts in your head. If you're thinking stressful thoughts, you're actually going to measurably reduce the amount of stomach acid you produce. That's your first protection against bad bacteria. Also, you'll make less digestive juices when those are necessary. If you're not focused on the food, or if there is a lot of stimulation that puts you into fight or flight mood. So if you have irritable bowel, cut out the coffee, cut out the alcohol, don't eat at your desk, go on a salad a day regimen, and stay away from the crap for a week and see if you still have irritable bowel. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.